If you listen to part one of our NFT for Musicians episode, which was the last episode, you learned what an NFT is, how they work, and how to make one. But should you? In this part two of NFT for Musicians, we are going to discuss the opportunities and if you should be looking at them and some of the potential pitfalls. So let's get to it.
You're listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY. DIY.
Musician.
Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 293 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner. Joining me is Chris Robley. And today's episode is part two of our two-part series on NFTs for musicians. In this one, we're going to dive into some of the opportunities, some of the things artists are excited about, and some of the things to look out for and potential pitfalls with this whole thing. And Chris, excited to have you back. We survived the first episode.
We did. You know, I actually thought I listened back to it because I know this.
Oh, you did? I was too scared to. By the end of it, I felt like I don't think I know anything.
I know this is a topic that is new to almost everyone on the entire planet. And so I listened back to see how we did. I thought we did a decent job of hopefully clarifying things, what an NFT is.
Yes. And
I also, I thought I did an amazing job with my movie trailer imitation as well.
Oh, yeah. You've sparked a whole new interest in a new career path for yourself.
Voiceover work, yeah.
In a world where Chris does voiceovers. Well, good. It's one of those things where the more I dive into it, it brings up a lot of questions. But we're going to talk about some of the opportunities today. And if you want some bite-sized content from the last episode, so if you haven't heard part one, you should probably go check it out. It'll make sense of this conversation. But on our YouTube channel, we sliced out some of the important things. And if you haven't been checking out our videos on YouTube, you should do so. Head on over there to youtube.com/CDBaby. Subscribe to our channel. But we have some of the content sliced out in some bite-sized chunks that are helpful just to get like the terms. I think that term list is very important because that's where a lot of people are like, I don't even know what we're talking about because there's a lot of terminology that's new. And if you're listening to the podcast and haven't subscribed, be sure you do subscribe. It's on YouTube, it's on Spotify, it's on Apple Podcasts and all the other podcast apps. And if you want to be extra cool, feel free to share it with your artist friends. Make sure they're listening.
Leave a review, do all the things.
Yeah, all the things.
We will appreciate it.
It's free, so giving us a thumbs up is an easy way to say thank you.
Yeah.
And tell YouTube that people like you love this stuff. So yeah, this conversation I think will be more interesting and help artists conceptualize, okay, I see where people are trying to go, what the opportunities are, and how this could make for positive change in the industry. Before we do that, though, Chris, one of the top questions we get here at CD Baby is, and about our suite of services, is do we offer any playlist pitching services or any pitching services? And the answer is yes. We've actually been piloting a program for a while that is just rolled out worldwide, and it's called CD Baby Stages. And there are a couple different stages, and if you qualify, it opens up more opportunities for us to work with you and your music. You can head over to cdbaby.com/stages to see what those qualifications are. The best part is there's no additional charge. It's a free added service to our artists, and I did say there are some qualification benchmarks you have to meet at certain levels, but the good news is a lot of people listening to this podcast already meet those qualifications, and this is just free help that you get with your release, whether it's expediting it, whether it's pitching it to the various DSPs or looking for other opportunities and making sure your release goes off without a hitch. So check out cdbaby.com/stages. If you've released with us, or even if you haven't released with us yet, check it out and see what we can offer you.
Yeah. And when this comes up sometimes in the live stream Q&As we do, we mention that this suite of services that we offer under the Stages name is really what some people in the industry call label services.
Correct.
So it's CD Baby's version of label services.
Yeah, we're trying to make it more scalable so it can be something that works for more artists. One of the biggest issues that label services companies have, or that artists would say, or their frustration about them, is that they can only work with a handful of labels are artists because they operate more like a label, but we're trying to make it something that can be more expansive and added features for artists. So cdbaby.com/stages, check it out. All right. So like we said, we got a great, I think we got a great show planned. NFTs, the opportunities. We also have some listener calls and emails at the end of the show. So be sure to stick around for that. And if you have any experience with NFTs as a musician, or if you have questions or comments, if you think this is the most amazing thing ever, or if you think it's just a bunch of baloney, we want to hear your thoughts and opinions and your questions, your comments. So call our listener line at 360-524-2209, or you can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com. And we're curious to see where the artist community is on this. So if you're like excited, if you're still feeling a bit clueless or lost, let us know. There's no judgment. There's no judgment here.
No judges.
Because, if you listen to the first episode of the podcast, we're still trying to figure it out ourselves. So, all right, we've got opportunities. Chris, you got a list of opportunities around NFTs that people are excited about, things people are trying, that they're putting in motion in order to try and create a music business that benefits the artist more directly.
Yeah, and I'll stick to the positive side of all these opportunities because we'll get to the pitfalls, as you said. But
yeah,
just to sort of quickly reiterate the vision for Web3, it is an internet where things are decentralized. So power moves away from big tech companies and governments and is in the hands of individuals, small communities, scenes, things like that. So if that is true, it's also a digital environment where artists can capture more of the value they're creating when they make content and post it online, as opposed to most of that value getting soaked up by the big tech companies. It gives you more control to move from platform to platform or to even invent your own platform rather than relying on existing tools. And potentially the value of your music can be separated from supply consideration. So now in Web 2, there's this pressure on the value of music because there's just so much music being made, 60,000 new releases a day. And when there's that volume and you apply some, Econ 101 supply demand, it means your music is worthless. And in order to make any money at all, you have to have just obscene volumes of consumption happening. And in Web 3, you can see that you have the tools to potentially live in a world where you're a little bit more like the painter at the farmer's market who says, hey, I made this painting and I say it's worth $150. Now, of course, you're still going to be subject to supply and demand stuff. Does anyone want to pay $150 for your painting? We don't know, but you get to say, I'm starting with that as my defined value, as opposed to saying, oh, well, 60,000 other paintings just came out, so my painting is worth nothing. So I think people are excited about that. Web3 and NFTs also solve for the problem of scarcity in a world where everything can be replicated. An NFT introduces scarcity. And if we have that, we might be a little bit more healthy as artists and not so obsessed with our metrics, like, oh, how many monthly listeners do we have this month? Is it going up? And if it doesn't go up, it means you're worthless. Well, no, it doesn't mean you're worthless. And Web3 tools and communities potentially help us feel better about ourselves, having great connection with smaller community of listeners.
Now, Chris, do you think artists are ever going to give up on those vanity metrics? Come on.
It's a dream, man. This is all part of the dream.
I mean, that's one of the main signs of an artist, someone who's obsessed with whether or not they're facing rejection or acceptance.
Right. Well, maybe your acceptance can come from a few people who pay you a whole lot of money as opposed to 10 million people who hardly pay you anything.
We can dream, Chris.
Just two other aspects of the utopia vision of Web3 is that the technologies and what you put out and how people pay you, what they do with their money, how they hold their money is supposed to be censorship resistant. And there's, of course, depending on where you're looking at that from and what society you live in, that might seem positive or negative. Like if you don't want a bunch of awful people to speak their mind with their money, then maybe you want some censorship. But if you live in a dictatorship, the exact same technology for you means freedom from those kinds of constraints. And then the other thing about blockchain, Web3 technology, it's immutable. It's supposed to, the transaction records are supposed to be permanent. Isn't that nice when we put so much energy into MySpace and then MySpace went away and we put energy into Facebook and now Facebook, we need to spend money to reach our audience. I'll hold my comment on the negative, possible negative side of that. But
we'll save that for the end.
Yeah.
But I think you mentioned sort of the political motivations that people have around the blockchain and Bitcoin, decentralized banking and stuff like that. But I think where artists may feel more of a connection to it is the idea of decentralizing from specific tech platforms that may start out as a good thing that turn into a raging dumpster fire and you feel like you're stuck using that platform. And that's why in the last episode, when I mentioned that YouTube said announced that they're going to have some sort of NFT, I'm like, how does that work? Because the idea of YouTube having NFTs is the exact opposite of what most people are talking about. Mm-hmm. When it comes to these things, it's like no one platform should be creating this walled off garden that then turns into to Death Valley.
Well, and you described in the last episode, you even said like purchasing an NFT in one of those platforms might just be more of like an in-app purchase at that point.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a good way of describing it.
Yeah. And that's where I think some of the confusion that we've seen with the way people are using that term pops up, that it starts to sound not like what we're talking about here with this decentralized thing that goes wherever and gives you something indefinitely. Once you've paid for it, the record is there that you own it. So if you haven't listened to that episode again, last time I'll say it, go listen to it. It's the one right before this. It'll help you understand some of the conversation today. But let's get into some of the opportunities. We've heard the utopia story, but what are people doing that looks like, hey, this is an interesting point to what could be in the future or the very soon now?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of uses. I think the most popularly covered in the media is digital collectibles. So there are groups of people who are uniting to try to purchase famous documents like the Declaration of Independence, who are owning the NFTs to super famous paintings like Matisse, Picasso, those, that sort of caliber of painting. NFTs is a sort of digital way of representing those bits of ownership. And then in the music world, we hear about how there's a percentage of resale that can be returned to the NFT creator. So if I made an NFT for a song, someone buys it, obviously I make most of that initial purchase, but I can also set a percentage that I'll earn anytime it's resold on like a secondary market. So anytime it changes hands, I get even more money, which is great because that doesn't happen if I sell a CD and then Kevin is like, I hate this CD. This sucks. I'm going to go to the local record store and earn $5 from it by selling it to them. And then they sell it. I don't ever see another cent from any of it except that initial time I ripped Kevin off by selling him that first CD.
Maybe if it wasn't blank, Chris.
That's where I went wrong. And then another thing we're hearing a lot about is fractional royalties, which would be the idea that you're selling an NFT to your fans or to investors on this promise that they will earn some small cut or maybe a giant cut, depending on how much they own, of however that song performs in the future, which is kind of cool. There's a way of using NFTs to do royalty splits to make payments fast and efficient. Then there's also the other popular thing of the Twitter profile pick. So this would be things like the Bored Ape Yacht Club and Crypto Mutants and whatever. You know, there's 1,000 of these things, but you get a little cartoon or animation or whatever that you can use as your digital avatar and you pay ridiculous amounts of money for that.
Well, it signifies you're a part of a group. That's kind of the idea.
Yeah, you're joining a little social club. And then another thing we talked about last time would be other kinds of utility, like we use the Foo Fighters as a potential example. They could say, hey, we're going to sell this NFT and any of our NFT owners get to do X. They get to attend this backstage party or something like that. So those are just a few of the examples of things that artists are doing.
Yeah. So there's a couple of them that are interesting to me that you mentioned. The percentage of resale amount, I think that's something when the NFT conversation popped up, this is one thing I saw a lot of people talking about. And your example of the CD at the used CD store was perfect. In fact, when I was in college and those stores were exploding everywhere, there actually were some lawsuits with artists saying that, hey, you're reselling our music and we're not getting a cut from it. And the artist did not win. And it was that said that, hey, I bought a physical CD, just like I might go buy a lawnmower or something else or a car. And it's my prerogative to turn around and resell that physical thing, which I could fall on both sides of the argument when it comes to intellectual property. But I think with NFTs, that was an idea of, well, let's solve for that. So somebody could buy this, and whenever they sell it, the artist or the original owner gets a little percentage. And every time it gets sold, you get a chunk. So as people continue to resell it, you get a chunk, which also could play into the idea that I mentioned. I threw out the Foo Fighters. Just to be clear, the Foo Fighters, I don't know what they're doing with NFTs. I just threw them out there because they're a band that's popular, and I could see them trying something like this where they could mint 100 NFTs and sell them for a price. Say there's 100 NFTs that go for $1,000 or 2,000, or somebody like them could probably go even higher. And anyone who owns that can show up to any show and get in and go to any, you know, they always have like a backstage party, or you get access to early releases or whatever you could think of. But there's a limited amount and they never mint more. But those fans, when they're like, I don't want this anymore, they could then in turn sell it to somebody else and sell it for more. And then the Foo Fighters would get a kickback again. And that chain keeps going. So you never sell more or mint more NFTs, but that collection of NFTs have value and can grow over time and can be resold. To me, that's an interesting idea as well, and could lead to some extra revenue where artists were typically missing out.
Well, that also makes me think of last week, you sort of said, what's the difference between this and crowdfunding? And of course, there's some similarities, but one huge difference is when you crowdfund something, you give a person money, and in return, you are given what they promised you. Potentially, if they're not a flake. And then it's done. You had your transaction, you gave your patronage, whatever, and then that's it. With an NFT, if you consider it patronage in any way, you literally have an asset. Yes, it's a digital asset. It's a token that lives in your wallet. But your patronage is now potentially worth something. It could be worth more down the line. So your crowdfunding, in essence, can make you money again down the line, depending on what happens with the career of that artist. But I think that's a huge difference between NFTs and crowdfunding.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing that really interested me in this idea is I have tried crowdfunding with two different bands and both times swore I'd never do it again.
Even though you were successful both times, we should clarify.
Let's put that in quotes, but yes.
I know exactly how you feel.
I probably still need therapy for those. But anyway, I think the interesting thing to me is in that process, I felt like I was trying to convince people to buy in for stuff that they really didn't want. You know, some of those fan-funded packages, it's like, I don't need all that junk. I'm wanting to support you. However, with NFTs, I feel like, oh, with this, I could probably be successful with far less people, because if I'm, say, giving them a piece of the action of the music or a part ownership, then those diehard fans, it's something unique and interesting to them. Like, I want to buy in. Not only do I love this band, but I actually own part of this album. I'm part owner. And so there's this idea of them feeling invested in it and wanting it to succeed and being motivated to potentially do a whole lot more to help promote the music and get people excited about it, because now they feel like they own a chunk of it.
Well, yeah,
that to me is interesting.
When you use the word invested, it's interesting because it's different connotations, but it's literally like all connotations of that word. They are literally investing in your music with money that they hope will give them something that goes up in value. And because of that, they are incentivized to do the work of evangelizing your music and seeing it succeed in ways that your crowdfunder is not, because they give you the money, they get the thing, and then it's done.
Yeah. The traditional crowdfunding felt more like, oh, I'm buying merch or I'm buying packages. It's like about me getting some thing tangible in return that may or may not have perceived value, meaning whether or not your fan cares about a t-shirt. Or I think to me, that was the struggle. You're like trying to put together these packages you think anyone will care about at price points you think are reasonable. And then all this work goes into it, where this, it just becomes, hey, you're a diehard fan. You want to own part of our music? It's like, oh, that's interesting. Buy in, the project happens and you get part ownership in this. I think we don't need to get into the details of smart contracts here and all that sort of detail, but because I really want to keep it more conceptual, people understanding the core ideas that have people excited. But, you know, the variation of that you and I have talked about, I don't know if we've talked about on the podcast, is what is the biggest problem artists have, or a lot of artists, and a lot of it is being able to afford to make the music. Unless you're a really accomplished home producer, at some point, one of the biggest barriers for us as artists is getting money to record and getting professionals to want to work on our music. And so thinking that, hey, you know, instead of getting that engineer for $500 to mix a song, maybe he's willing or she's willing to do it for $250 and they get a piece of ownership of this song and a minted NFT around it that they can do what they want with it. We're going to get into some of the problems in a minute that address some of these issues. But but to me, from a concept, that is an interesting problem, or a solution that feels like it addresses a real problem that we face as artists.
Yeah, totally. Should we read the tweet?
Yeah, we can read. There was a tweet by an artist. Before that, though, a couple of the opportunities on the list, like the social club, to me, that's not interesting at all. I know a lot of people that love it, but to me, that one feels like a bit of a fad. It feels like a bunch of
It's because you have a deep sense of belonging. That's just, you had a good upbringing. You have all the things in your life you need to feel good about yourself and loved. But those of us who are desperate, need belonging.
it feels like one of those things early adopters do to show that they're early adopters. And once everyone else adopts it, nobody cares.
Yeah.
And that's where I feel like the value starts to subside. But I could be wrong. You know, there are social clubs in the real world, like whether it's a country club, people pay to just be a part of a thing and it has some status. It could be that. As far as opportunities for artists, I don't think that's the first place I look, at least not me.
My one rebuttal would be, while the Bored Ape Yacht Club and things like that do signify blockchain early adopters, it's a sort of a status symbol thing. It could just as easily be the 4-H Club or the Boy Scouts, or it could be the BTS fan club. So there's any number of interests you can align around in some kind of way like this. But
I think what's important for it to work is the exclusivity, where like 4-H, you're not going to be necessarily exclusive, or the Boy Scouts, where with a social club like BTS, I'm surprised they haven't dropped something. Maybe they have. I just missed it, because to me, that would be somebody where, again, a limited number, 1,000 people, and they could charge an enormous amount because they're so huge. And you can only 1,000 people could have this, and it gets some sort of bonus. Maybe you get an exclusive Zoom call with BTS once a month.
I'm sure they could charge hundreds of thousands of dollars per NFT if that's
People would resell. Yeah, it'd be crazy. So I think we're going to talk about some of the main issue for artists coming up, but let's get to that tweet that you mentioned.
This is a series of tweets by an artist named RAC, who is quite well known in some circles, but not like a household name like Drake or Billie Eilish or something like that. Mm-hmm. So kind of a successful indie type story. So he says, okay, so you hate NFTs. Cool. Let's talk about it. I'm not going to convince you, but at least I can offer the perspective of an artist who has been involved in the space since 2017, before any of you heard about it. First off, ecological concerns. This is basically solved pending imminent implementation. And then just editor's note, he means some improvements that are happening to the Ethereum blockchain. Okay, then he goes on. A lot of people seem to miss that the entire point of NFTs is to make content free while making ownership scarce. Nobody is forcing you to pay for an NFT. You can still enjoy it for free alongside everybody else. You like my music? You can have it for free. Scarce ownership empowers artists to make way more income without stupid ad-based models. It eliminates models like Spotify, Apple, all those platforms. Unit-based per-play economics in an infinitely copyable medium makes no sense whatsoever. This is a drastic economic shift, and it flips the entire model that we've grown accustomed to. A model that has held back several generations of artists predating the internet. This is a profound change. I think of NFTs as a pseudo-file format. It's completely open to anybody. Because of this, there is a very wide spectrum of projects that have surfaced, some great, some not so great. This is how the internet works. It's up to the individual to filter through these. Claiming all NFTs are a scam is about as tone-deaf and uninformed as it gets. It's pure ignorance. It's like saying all cheese is bad or that all music sucks. Yeah, some are bad, but like anything, there are tasteful and smart and interesting ways to do anything. We're in the first real wave of mainstream adoption, and the tech is still kind of janky, and some questionable projects are having success. The market has not weeded those out yet because we're in year one of a multi-decade wave. Do you think a $10,000 profile pick project is a Ponzi scheme? Here's a thought. Don't buy it. If you squint hard enough, literally everything is a Ponzi. The stock market, the US dollar, etc. Now every person that took Econ 101 is suddenly an expert. I've personally taken a more fine art collector first kind of approach than mass marketing my NFTs. It's more of my speed and I can focus on a smaller subset of people. I have 3.5 million unique listeners per month on Spotify, yet I made more income from 5 collectors. Am I scamming them? Would you like to ask them? And then he actually puts their Twitter handles if you want to ask them. I put everything I have into creating something that is moving and artistic. Meanwhile, Web2 platforms that exploit gamers and their makers come out saying it's a scam. It's not a scam. It just makes them irrelevant. We don't need to convince you to join the revolution. Just continue to enjoy the free content we make for you, except this time we're actually getting paid for it. How that is offensive, I do not know. Also this, I made more income from one NFT drop than my 15-year career as a musician. Can I be exploited some more?
And what was the artist's name again?
RAC.
Yeah. And there was some good thoughts in there. I think the model, it looks like he's leaning into, feels like Patreon to me. And my first question would be, well, what he's doing is an NFT required? Like asking these people, hey, would you just be a patron? Would that get the same result? Maybe not. I would like to know more about the collector projects he's doing, because he said he's focusing on more like the fine art collector.
Yeah, and given that he's been in the space for so long, my guess would be that he's sort of like a test case for the NFT amongst the tech crowd. So the people who were in on Ethereum really early, they probably have a relationship. And I don't even mean that in some cynical way. I'm sure it was sort of just a symbiotic thing. He was making music. He wanted to experiment with this technology. He happened to have the right connections to this community of people who were interested in the test case. So I think there is an early adopter thing to it. But I also don't think that means it's not a good example.
No, I think what happens with early adopter success oftentimes is you get early adopters doing something and the community that's really excited about that thing really rally around it because they want it to succeed. Or to me, I was thinking about it, it feels a little bit like when I first started working at CD Baby and realizing that, remember Marianne Kennedy?
Oh yeah.
Her CDs were priced at $20 a piece. And she sold an enormous amount of them every day. And all her songs were about horses. And the album art was always a picture of a horse. And people who loved horses bought her music like crazy because it was like speaking to that community directly. And I feel like that was in my mind sort of felt like, oh, early adopters are speaking to a specific community. So it's like, you're speaking my language. I want to support you. And then that doesn't exist for every artist. You know, I'm not in the NFT community. So no one in the NFT community that's trying to show the promise here is going to rally around me. It's me trying to get my regular fans to even understand what NFTs are.
Right.
And I think that's where the challenge and Let's lead into some of the problems.
Before we get to the problems, I had a couple things to say. So okay. That RAC tweet is all kind of like the roses around this situation. Yeah. There is a really great blog article by a guy named Black Dave, who has been successful in the NFT world. So he got in fairly early in the grand scheme of things as well, had success, but he wrote an article called Sharp, which is the name of his song he released as an NFT. So it's Sharp, After the Sale and Next Steps. And I recommend anyone interested Google that, because he basically, if I sum up the experience that he describes in the article, it's like, oh my God, I just sold the NFT after grinding and grinding and filling myself with doubt and regret and fear and sleepless nights. And it was essentially the experience of crowdfunding that you are describing, Kevin. Like, this sucked. It was so much work. And then at the end of it, I still win and I like this format. I'm going to do it again. But let's be real, it's not easy. So I loved how it was a triumphant tale, but with all of the sweat and blood baked into it. Yeah. So people should read that for sure.
Yes. And then
the other thing I would say is Water and Music is a music industry research organization, and they did a thing called Stream Report, which is a 5-part series all about NFTs and Web3. But some of the information in there is sort of case studies of NFT artists, and they're pretty clear-eyed about where things stray from the vision, where people stumbled and did things wrong. So like, if you want the warts of all this, you should read that research project as well.
Yes. All right. Now you've got your list, your top 10 problems with NFTs.
All right. Here are the 10 problems with NFTs. First, NFTs do not invent demand. Just because my neighbor has a voice memo of his dog barking and it's the only one that exists doesn't mean anyone wants to buy it. So just like in a lot of other areas, scarcity is not your problem. Obscurity probably is. Another thing is that your fans are probably not Web3 natives. So you're going to have a ton of work ahead of you to onboard them to this crypto world. Three, that's a lot harder than just inviting someone to a new social network where they push a couple buttons and put their email in. Crypto is hard and super confusing and scary, so your onboarding experience will be very difficult if your fans aren't already there. If your fans aren't crypto natives, to the uninitiated, there will be a lot of confusion about what separates your NFT project from just crowdfunding or merchandising, mm-hmm. which puts a lot of pressure on you to clearly communicate in an exciting way. And, you know, musicians, we don't love copywriting and stuff like that. So another problem, crypto is volatile. And yes, I know the US dollar is volatile and there's inflation and blah, blah, blah. But if you look at a crypto chart for any, you know, Bitcoin, it's like, so then you're like asking your fans to spend crypto and they're like, I don't even know what that's worth in like 5 minutes. Nor do you, the artist.
Yeah.
Fractional royalty. So this is where you tell your fans if they buy this NFT, they stand to gain some royalties as the song performs better. But guess what? That potentially gets you into securities violation. So unless you want to become friends with the SEC and do all this paperwork, that's going to be a ton of work. Environmental concerns. It's debatable whether there are truly environmental concerns with blockchain technology when you compare it to Google searches or the oil industry or even the gaming industry. But the popular narrative is that blockchain is bad for the environment, which means you have another hurdle of getting over in order to tell your fans that this is green. Another problem is shady people are everywhere in the crypto world. They want to scam you. They want to hack your wallet. They want to take your Ethereum. If they're not individual hackers, there might just be scams like the hit piece thing that happened a few weeks ago. So wild, wild west with all of the possibilities, but also all the gunslingers who want to just kill you and take your money. Another thing is people say it's permanent, that an NFT is permanent, that stuff on the blockchain is permanent. But if an NFT just points to a URL, the stuff on that URL could change. If you stop paying for your web hosting, it could just disappear completely. So that makes the promise of your NFT very questionable. And lastly, your success in the NFT world to some degree is based on your genre, your scene, because right now, as it stands, the crypto world is very sort of future facing. They like music that involves electronic music productions, like EDM, ambient, hip hop, very modern pop, stuff like that. It's not so much a place that is a proving ground yet for singer-songwriters and jazz and folk. I'm sure that it'll get there, but right now, it doesn't seem to be a gold rush for those types of music. And a bonus problem. Here's the bonus problem. What the hell do you do with copyright if the blockchain is immutable and you literally don't have the rights to put an NFT on there, but you do, and it lives there forever? Complicated business.
Yeah,
those are,
I think,
10 plus a bonus problem with NFTs.
Yeah, I think the copyright issue is one that's, with some of those scams or things that popped up or shady people that have made some news recently, we already know there's a lack of understanding what copyright really means and what rights it gives you and what buying a CD or an album from an artist means compared to owning the intellectual property on that CD. Two different things. There's a lot of confusion around that when people buy these things, and that's where it's going to be a challenge. Yeah, like you said, what happens to crypto and any of these NFTs if the global power grid goes down forever?
Then literally everything becomes valueless, right?
Yeah. So at least in the digital space, having real things might become more valuable.
Like a music box.
Yeah, there you go. Or an acoustic guitar.
Or, okay, yeah, as long as you can get strings.
Yep. So, yeah, there's lots of things to work out and issues that that space is dealing with that are challenging. And there's that list is pretty daunting. And there's going to be continued forward progress to ease some of the trouble that comes with the copyright issue is a tough one. But some of just like the, like you said, getting a wallet and getting cryptocurrency isn't like going to the ATM and getting some cash.
Yeah.
It's a challenge, and getting your fans on board and them understanding and then going through all this stuff. There's a lot of work that needs to happen, which then to me makes me think, well, can it truly go mainstream while still staying decentralized? That would be my question.
I think that's a really good question. And I think in 5 years, we'll know, or maybe 10. But I do think even if it stays completely decentralized, I think people are solving the ease of use issues.
Yeah, to me, that's one of those things where over time, things will get simplified and things will connect better and easier.
Yeah, I think if we backtrack through some of these concerns, the one that's probably most important to me is the one I said first. Like, just because you have an NFT doesn't mean anything. Doesn't mean anyone wants it. It doesn't mean it's special. It doesn't mean you have buyers. We emphasized that in the last episode as well. But unless you have people who are eager to jump as soon as you launch the thing, it's just going to be like anything else that you need to market. You need to tell the story. Mm-hmm. You probably need to tell the story of the NFT 20 different ways. It's a lot of legwork and a lot of hustle. So don't go into this like a gold rush thinking you're just going to show up at the river and like a nugget of gold will land in your palms. You might have to buy the gear. You know, what do you need for gold rush? You need a pan. You need a...
Most people died broke from the gold rush.
Yeah. Expect to die broke.
Well, here's my hot take, Chris. NFTs seem geared toward driving scarcity in a digital world where scarcity does not exist. Scarcity does not create demand, and you must already have demand in order to harness the idea of scarcity for indie artists. And if you're focusing on creating scarcity when you don't have true fans, you're wasting your time, because your biggest problem is not scarcity. Your biggest problem is that nobody knows who you are. So scarcity doesn't matter. They didn't know they wanted you in the first place. And that's just my opinion. I'd love to hear what other artists think. You can leave a comment down below on the video, or you can call our listener line at 360-524-2209, or you can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com. But that's my hot take. I feel like most artists get so focused on trying to make their music scarce when there's no demand. So that just drives down the potential for any value in it.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And it reminds me of in the piracy days, there was a similar retort to the music industry or to a lot of artists. Just, yeah, piracy is not your problem. The problem is no one wants to steal your music.
Yeah. I remember when we get that call all the time, like, look, trust me, they're trying to pirate stuff that seems to have market value, not stuff just because they want to collect random MP3 files.
Yeah.
That's not what people are doing. And so to me, it's like you got to have some sort of measurement of demand before you can start playing the scarcity card, because you got to have demand first.
I completely agree with that. The one thing I'm excited about around that topic is that, again, the dream of Web3 is that defining demand is a little bit more in your hands as the artist. So it's not going to be determined by Spotify's monthly listener metric. And if you have 100 fans or that 1,000 true fans model, you might have enough of a fan base there to create demand around scarcity. Does that make any sense? You might not need millions, is what I'm saying.
Yeah,
you might
just need a few hundred. And I agree with that. And that's sort of the original promise of fan funding. It's like you don't need 100,000 people streaming your songs constantly in order to make some money. You could have 5 people that just love what you do so much that they see more value in it. I mean, there's some artists where I feel that way, where if they said, hey, we haven't made any albums in a while, we would make another one if everyone gave $20. I'd be like, yeah, I want another album by that artist. So I understand that changing the metrics to be around making stuff that other people want to enjoy, whether that's 5, 100, 1,000, or 1,000,000, and you being able to determine that. That's a nice idealistic viewpoint, but there's still some other market drivers that make that hard.
Yeah, we'll see.
Any final thoughts, Chris? We got to move on to our calls and emails, which we have today.
Yeah, just really quick. If you're interested in Web3 and the crypto world and how it interfaces with music opportunities, one alternative to the NFT, which is this sort of like unique item, is that you could do a social token, which is fungible, to return to our ridiculous terms from the last episode. But you could say, hey, I'm going to mint $10,000 of Chris Robley coin. And in fact, there is a sort of a famous Bitcoin evangelist who likes to give the example of, in the future, little kids in kindergarten will take like finance classes and they'll all set up a crypto wallet and they'll all mint Jane coin and Mikey coin or whatever. And then those will all be worthless up until the point that one of them turns into Justin Bieber. And then Justin Bieber coin from his kindergarten days will be his social token that is worth millions. But you could, as an older person.
That just makes me feel like society's doomed if that's what we're doing.
You want to return to banging sticks and rocks together?
Well, it just seems like now kindergartners are bullying each other. Whose crypto is going to be more popular?
They'll be shilling and inflating the pumping and dumping their coins on.
Yeah.
Did you see what she had for lunch? Oh, God.
Yeah, I know.
Dump.
She got her hair cut. Yeah. Sell. Get rid of that.
Well, so the social token is one thing I kind of like, because it could be around an individual artist. It could be around a label, could be around a local music scene. Anyone who has the technical wherewithal to create these things, and it's getting easier because a lot of this stuff is open source. I do think that's a potential cool way of organizing a community. When you do organize a community in that way, you're going to have to set rules about governance and like, what does it mean for someone to hold a lot of your tokens? Do they get any say in the direction of your music? Hopefully not. Hopefully they invested in you as the artist because they trust you. But these are all things you'd have to consider. And does anyone get more rights in the community if they hold more of the tokens, all these things? But I think there'll be some cool use cases for that as well.
Yeah, I think there's some interesting things, and it's going to develop. And, you know, while we've said there's pitfalls and it's fun to make snarky comments about it, I think there is a lot of interesting things happening. And that's why we wanted to highlight the opportunities and some of the negative stuff or the pitfalls or things that crypto is going to face as problems. Some of them will get solved, but part of it I wanted to highlight because there is just so much confusion about what's happening. And I've seen, leading up to the recording of this podcast in the last couple of weeks, some people try things that you're like, now that is a scam. That is just somebody trying to get people to buy in, or, you know, we won't highlight it here, but there was one that we saw that when we were digging into it, I'm like, that sounds like a pyramid scheme. Not just throwing that term around loosely, like that really did seem like a pyramid type scheme.
I'm laughing because as I've gone down the Web3 rabbit hole, I've also, for the first time in my life, taken an interest in finance and investment and stuff. So I'm very loosely spying on some trading groups and listening to their conversations. And the crypto has so much lingo that I still don't quite get. But I laugh all the time when there's this phrase that people use. They say good Ponzi, which is like, oh, this is a complete scam just like everything else here. But I think it's a good short-term investment. Let's get in on that. It's like a pump and dump.
Yeah,
kind of a tacit agreement, but they just say good Ponzi. Like, and it's funny because it almost sounds like they're giving it a legitimate compliment.
Yeah.
Anyways, good Ponzi.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how this develops. Again, if you have done something with NFTs and have some advice to share, some experiences, whether good or bad, or you have questions or comments, feel free to call our listener line at 360-524-2209 or email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com. And with that, unless there are any other final words, Chris, because this topic isn't over. It's just going to be ongoing.
We've said it all. It's locked tight for the next decade. Nothing will change.
Unless you have any other final words, let's get to some calls.
Let's do it.
All right. Let's get to a call.
Hey guys, I love your podcast. It's a wealth of information. So my question is about upgrading to pro publishing. I am a solo artist. I compose all my own music and I go by two bad names against your advice. I go by In Dark Solitude, which is a horror haunt Halloween style. And then I go by a band called The Atomic Tiki, which is Tiki Lounge jazz music. My question is, I started using CD Baby at the inception. So I've got 13 releases under In Dark Solitude, and going back and looking at some old releases, those are the ones that are really making a lot of money for me. So this is before I knew what I was doing, and I did not use the pro, unfortunately. So when I go in there and, you know, view edit, try to upgrade to pro, it makes me go through the songwriting list again. And I see my name twice. One has the dollar symbol next to it because obviously that's my pro, and the other one doesn't. So when I try to use my pro with the dollar symbol, it basically won't let me do it because it says it's making it 200%. And I'm kind of stuck because if I use the one that is not a pro, I can't upgrade to pro. And if I use the other one, I probably won't be able to finish this. So any advice you could give me would be great. Appreciate it. Keep up the good work. You guys have a really great show. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. First off, I want to address his comment about the different names. Actually, in this scenario, I think that is the right call to use two different artist personas and names because those two types of music are very different.
I completely agree.
Yeah. So just for the record, we don't think that you should never have alternate projects with different names. We just think in most situations, artists are doing something that feels more like artistic growth or natural progression of change over time as compared to a horror rock and a tiki jazz.
Tiki jazz. Yeah.
Those are two different audiences. But to the pro question, it sounds like, and he's referring to CD Baby Pro, our pro publishing administration service at CD Baby. It sounds like you just need to remove the old writer designation from that song and leave the one with the dollar sign in there. So you remove the non-collecting songwriter, which is you, for the profile that has the collecting information, and it should be back to 100%.
I have that same issue in my own account, and I forget exactly why. I think at some point I signed up a song that I did not claim publishing on because it was already being claimed elsewhere. Anyways, and so I have the dollar sign version of my name and the non-dollar sign. So I just certainly moving forward, always just choose your dollar sign name.
Correct. All right. Now we've got an email. And this, Chris, is from our Instagram live stream yesterday.
Oh.
An artist named Carl asked a couple questions about waterfall releases. And then he emailed the podcast as a follow-up. So as a little background, waterfall releases, that term gets used in multiple ways. From what I've gathered, the official meaning of it is that You go to Spotify, there's one link. You go to that release, and the link doesn't change, and the album listing doesn't change, but it keeps adding songs over time. Not available to independent artists by and large. And it's not even really officially supported by Spotify. I've had our distribution people confer with Spotify about it so I could really get to the bottom of it. There's another way people refer to a waterfall release, is which is more in line of what we talk about with a release strategy of like releasing a single or two from the album and then releasing the whole album. That technically is not a waterfall release because the singles have their own listing still on Spotify. So that's a little context for his question. So, because he asked that on the Instagram live stream yesterday. Hey there, fellas. I'm the guy who asked about waterfall releases on the IG live stream. You replied that there was no real benefit to these types of releases. I sort of disagree as a fan because I had a lot of anticipation for each release when a band that I like released their album this way, but maybe I'm in the minority. Wouldn't be the first time. And then he goes into some of the economics. And I really think that what Carl's talking about is not truly the real waterfall where that one listing on Spotify slowly populates and becomes an album, but more like the strategy we're talking about of releasing a couple singles and then an album, because he goes on into some of the economics of doing it. But the one thing, and the one reason I wanted to include this in the podcast, is because if you do that traditional waterfall thing, one, you're going to have to work very closely with the distributor because it's sort of a hack on the distribution side that if you were with a label or working with an artist like Taylor Swift, you're willing to take the time to do. But when you're distributing thousands and thousands of artists, you're not going to take the time to do. So for an independent artist, it's going to be hard to find someone that will do that for them. But you only get the opportunity for the Spotify pitching tool when you have an official release. So if you do this sort of weird waterfall hack to the album listing on Spotify, you're not going to get the benefit of your track being pushed to all your fans on Release Radar, having an opportunity to be considered for playlists. With the traditional, or the what's becoming the strategy we recommend, where you release a couple singles, like one this month, one next month, and the album the following month. In each of those releases, you do get access to the Spotify for Artists pitching tool, and those songs and whatever song you select off the album will be pushed to your fans through Release Radar. So to me, that's the way to go.
Well, I think one intermediary process between those two things is like another way of people describing the waterfall is they put out a single, and then they put out another single later that also contains the previous single. Then they put out another single, and that contains the previous two. And so it keeps growing every time they put out a new release, which needs a new UPC. It's technically a new single, EP, album, whatever, as it grows. They're all separate releases. And then whether you want to go in and delete the previous instance of those songs, I've seen people do it. I've seen people say a lot of nice things about it. It sounds like a whole lot of juggling and work when you could just be adding the newest releases to a playlist that never changes and always driving people to your playlist.
Yeah, I think the Spotify for Artists tool, when they added the pitching piece, really killed the idea of what people saw the major label artists doing. When I experienced it from a band I like, I was incredibly confused because the idea is, hey, the link never changes. The place on Spotify never changes. And that's just not a problem in our streaming world. It's not a problem to solve for. It's not an issue.
Like when you get the ad on Instagram, you're like, wait a minute, that's a different link than the last time I was interested in this topic.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's just not a problem. The way the platforms allow artists to merchandise their music, it's not a problem to solve for. So the other thing that when he's talking about the economics, he's like, here's the main reason I asked the question. As you yourself have suggested in the past, a good strategy for an indie artist is to stay top of mind to listeners is to keep a constant stream of releases coming. But if I were to release 12 song album, a single at a time, with the full album being the final release, it'd get expensive. But I don't think you should have a 12 song album and release every song as a single. That is not a good strategy. A good strategy is to have a couple leading up to an album, because after three or four singles leading up to an album, people are going to tune you out. It's like, just drop the album. And plus, we all know as artists, when we release a 12-song album, we may think every song is the most perfect little baby of ours.
Gems.
Yeah. But the reality check is they're not. they all may be great, but there are some that are going to connect more than others. And by that 10th song or 11th song, when you're getting down to the bottom of the barrel, it's like, it's enough already. So to me, two singles, then the album. That's your strategy. That's what you should do. All right, let's get to our last call. And by the way, Carl, thanks for participating in our Instagram live stream and asking questions and following up here. I hope that was helpful. All right, we've got one more call. Let's get to it.
Hey guys, this is Brian calling from Reality Suite in New Jersey. Again, I want to thank you guys for doing this weekly podcast because this is awesome. I used to look forward to your podcast every month, and now I know it's like a consistent thing, and it's great. I'm really happy about this. Anyway, quick question. So, about songwriting. Now, my band will be covering a song from a band that I used to be in 20 years ago. I was not a part of the writing of the song. It was a bigger song for us. And that band broke up in the mid-2000s, and the two songwriters have no interest in being a part of the song or, you know, any success that that song may have. So, for example, I reached out to the singer. We're on good terms. You know, we have a friendship. But his attitude was really like, look, I don't really care what happens. And I explained to him residuals, and, you know, he may want to sign up with a publisher. Didn't care to be bothered. I reached out to the guitar player, who was also a co-writer on the song, and he did not want to bother either. Didn't even respond to me. I know he was a little bit salty about how the band broke up, but anyway, I know ethically what I should do. I should put them down as the songwriters, obviously. But my concern is, well, any residuals, how little as they may be, will they be going into limbo? And if they're going into limbo, should I then put myself down or my other bandmates down as co-writers so that at least those residuals are going to somebody? I understand the ethics. So I understand ethically we were not the songwriters. And I want to be transparent with my two previous song or bandmates. But again, what's your opinion on that? And what do you think I should do? Thanks a lot. I'm Brian from the band Reality Suite. Have a great day.
Chris, what's your take on that?
I have a very definitive answer. Do not put your own names as the songwriters. That is potentially opening up a can of worms and inviting a lot of problems. However, couldn't he, through CD Baby Pro Publishing, only if it's a co-writer. I was thinking we could still collect on their behalf, and it would be his responsibility to take those royalties and pay them to the songwriters. But I don't think we can do that unless he's a writer.
Yeah. When I was listening to his message, I thought, well, he should still credit them as the songwriters, but he could be the publisher and own the song, because that's what the publishing world is. That publishing company owns the songs and they still pay the songwriters. That seemed like the way to go in this situation. Maybe, like you're saying, he should say, hey, in order for me to collect this money, I'm going to put myself in as 10% of the song ownership or something like that. Or maybe they could say, hey, you know, like some bands, even though there's like a one or two main songwriters, based on how they want the money to work, they might give everybody equal credit on songs. I've seen that happen as well. So that could be a conversation like, hey, can I give everyone equal credit on this? And then as we promote and continue to drive value for this song, we can get paid some money for it too, since you aren't interested and we're doing all this work. That might be an option.
Here's a question. Did he say whether the song had, under the previous band, had actually been released officially?
My assumption was it had.
Because if so, they could just release it as a cover. And as long as he divorces himself from the idea that he'll ever see any publishing money, then his band will now collect all the sound recording royalties. And then whether the songwriters get paid or not isn't his problem.
Yeah, that's true. It's an interesting scenario. I'd be curious to see if anyone else listening has had similar things pop up where it's like you have band members leave, and how have you dealt with that? ongoing rights conversation around songs, because especially in a situation where people are like, I'm not interested, and maybe it sounds like he's pretty excited about this song. I don't think he specified whether or not it had been released, but if it hadn't, that might change the equation a little bit. Then he could say, hey, here's $200. I'm going to buy this song from you and just call it mine.
Send them nice gift baskets in the mail. And what did they like when you were still in a band? You know, a year's subscription to ESPN or so. I don't know.
Is that what does it?
Just warm them up a little bit and be like, you know, I know we didn't end on the best terms, but
yeah,
you like sports.
That's right. There you go. Interesting question. I don't know if we have any more of a definitive or other ideas than what we've said, but I wanted to share because I was curious to see what if other artists are feeling like they're finding themselves in this same kind of scenario where somebody leaves who contributed and now you got to deal with moving forward and they're not interested. All right. Well, thanks for your calls and emails. If you want to weigh in on a topic from NFTs to getting back out on the road to promoting your music to releasing music or have questions, feel free to call our listener line at 360-524-2209, or you can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com. And yeah, that's going to bring us to the end.
The only thing I was going to say in closing is get your tickets to the DIY Musician Conference in Austin.
That's right.
This summer. We'll see you there.
Chris and I are actually leaving in 2 days from the recording of this to go to Austin and start some of the planning. It's real. It's happening.
It's happening.
And you should be there. It's going to be, I think, a great way after this pandemic to get back together with like-minded people and get excited about your career. Touring starting to happen again. And a lot has changed in the music business. We're going to have a lot of DSPs and other platforms there that you'll have access to talk to. CD Baby will be there. It's a great time. Love it. DIYMusicianCon.com. Tickets are only $99 right now. That's a screaming deal. And so you can get it while it's still $99. All right.
All right.
We survived 2 episodes about NFTs. How did we do it?
Now we can move on to something that musicians actually care about.
And what would that be, Chris? Maybe we should ask, what do you care about? Tell us what you want
to
cover.
Oh, yeah, what do you care about?
Leave it in the comments of the video version or email us or call us. What's on your mind? We want to know.
All right.
All right. Well, that's going to do it. We'll catch you next time. See ya.
See ya.
You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.